I'm Jean Marie. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 25th, 2002. You know, whenever I give my sobriety date, I always think to myself what I was doing on that day and how I was feeling. The 29th is my grandson's birthday, and I was determined that I was going to be sober on his birthday. So even though I have 8 years sober, I was sober for 9 of his birthdays. He's in college now at Fresno State. You know, he's turned out to be a very nice young man, and that's part of the rewards you get for sobriety. That's part of the thing that's been such a blessing to me. I started out my drinking career pretty much like everybody else. You know, I had my first drink at 16. I don't know how we did this, but we managed to talk my mother into letting me spend the night at my friend's house when her mom wasn't there. And we got some guy to buy us vodka, and we didn't know, even have the sense enough to know you were supposed to mix anything with it, so we just poured it in a glass and drank it as fast as we could, so that we thought that's what you did. And, you know, even at the height of my, you know, alcoholism, I never drank vodka, because I never have been so sick in my life with that. You know, I was talking with somebody before the meeting, one of the ladies, and I was sharing that I only drank alcoholically for a couple of years, but every decision that I ever made in my life that was poor, any time I ended up where I shouldn't have been, any time that I made really bad decisions, I was always drinking. You know, it didn't catch up with me for a really long time, and I didn't really think I had that problem. But looking back on it, I really had the ism of alcoholism. It really kicked my butt. I was a person that always moved. You know, I was sharing before the meeting that I worked up and down the state of California. I worked in Alaska. In fact, Alaska was where my drinking caught up with me. That's where it just about kicked me out. Once my kids were grown, I thought, well, I got it made. I was a young mom. I got married real young, and I was a kid raising a kid. And I would like to address that to the ladies that are in the recovery home, to think about the relationship that you're establishing with your children when you're drinking, and the relationship you're establishing with the kids when you're sober, because it's really, really important. You know, there's really a stigma for being a drunk lady. You know, once you're drunk, you're not a lady. You know, for being a drunk woman. Women are supposed to be moms. We're supposed to be, you know, making the home. We're supposed to be doing all that kind of stuff. And when we're out there doing our thing, I don't know about you guys, but I wasn't very much of a lady. You know, I was always raised, my mom is real pitch-it English, you know, and she always, you know, pinkies up and all that stuff when we had our little tea and we did all that kind of stuff. But towards the end, when I was drinking alcoholically, I couldn't put my pinky up if I couldn't lift the glass. Because I've got little hands, and I drank it out of a big iced tea glass, and I drank it with both hands so I could hold it steady. And believe you me, I didn't have my pinky out. I did not have my pinky out. My children grew, and I just took it in my mind that I could just go anywhere I wanted to, and so I did. I work in a profession that allows me to pretty much get a job anywhere I go, and that's what I did. I went from here to there, usually involved with some man, looking for the adventure, you know, looking for Mr. Right, Mr. Wonderful, Mr. Goodbar, you know, never having any knowledge in myself that I didn't have to look for that, that everything I needed was right here. It was there all along, like it is with all of us. You know, we have what we need inside of ourselves, and that's the beauty of this program, is that it enables you to develop that within yourself. When I started drinking alcoholically, I was in Alaska. I was on my fifth marriage. I had a really, really bad neck injury. And let me tell you, the first time I took a Vicodin and washed it down with the bourbon and 7, it was on. it was on big time. You know, I couldn't hear that husband. I couldn't hear anything. I couldn't feel anything. I wasn't sad because I was away from my children. I didn't care that I left my grandchildren behind after yet another disaster that I had basically brought to the family. I exposed my children and my grandchildren to people that they shouldn't have been exposed to. And I went to Alaska. I thought, well, I'll just run off and I'll just marry this Alaska man and, you know, be Mrs. Yukon Jack or something. I don't know what I thought I was going to do, but I was trying to describe to a normie today. We were talking about working in various jobs, and this woman was an RN, and she was saying she can't understand, you know, why people just don't quit. You know, when you go to them and say, well, you need to stop drinking. You know, like, duh, don't you think we know that? And I told her, I said, let me tell you what it feels like to not be able to not drink. I said, it feels like you're in a horrible flood, and you see one of your kids floating downstream, and you reach your hand out to grab them, and you can't quite reach them, or they slip right through your fingers. And that sense of, oh, my God, you know, that deep despair, you know, talk about that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And she was just so surprised to know that the depth that we feel when we can't stop drinking. You know, it's one thing when we're doing our deal, you know, we're having a good old time and hoochie doo and all that kind of stuff. And it's quite another thing when we all know it's time to stop for one reason or another. Maybe it's the nudge from the judge, or maybe it's, you know, your own deep knowing within you. I know for a lot of you ladies, it's probably with your kids, you know, and to not be able to stop. It was horrible. It was the most horrible thing. By profession, I'm a social worker, and I'd like to say that I'm all that in a bag of shit, but actually, I'm a social worker because my kids were so screwed up by my behavior that I started going to school to try to make it better. I started taking psychology classes and, you know, doing that deal, and ended up having kind of an affinity for it. And that's how I ended up being a social worker. But most of my education was the same as yours. We got our PhD in the School of Hard Knocks. You know, we know how that feels. We know how it feels to have that complete despair. It was awful. It was just the most awful thing I've ever experienced in my life. The day that I quit drinking, I was in a neck cast here. I had three ruptured discs in my neck, probably from being drunk and climbing up trees with a chainsaw. And then when I sawed my electric cord in half, I jumped down out of the tree. And, you know, all those crazy things that we do. I watched the Discovery Channel. I saw this orangutan kind of up hanging in a tree. And I thought, oh, that looks so familiar to me. And I thought, yeah, that was you. You were up there like an orangutan hanging in this tree, crawled up there. I didn't even get on the ladder to put a light bulb in. I don't know what I thought I was doing. Threw my chainsaw, electric, of course, over my shoulder, climbed up this tree, was hanging on one side, put my foot in the crotch of the tree, swung over like that, and I had my chainsaw going, yin, 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 with my other hand until I saw the cord in half, and it sparked, and I went, jumped out of the tree. And then I wonder why my neck is ruptured. It was probably going for a long time, but, you know, I did those kind of things, and I think we all do crazy stuff. You know, I look back on myself and go, my God, it's a wonder I didn't get killed, let alone all the times I drove drunk. And I'm very sad to say some of those times with my kids in the car back in the day. I can't even describe to you how low I felt the day that I quit drinking. I had been praying. I knew what was happening to me. I knew I was in the critical stage. I could not stop. I mean, I went out in a blizzard, for God's sake, to get a bottle in Alaska. There's no grocery store stuff. You have to go to, like, they call them a package store or something like that. And I would go into these places, and I'd be going like, hi, hey, what's up? You know, and they're like, what's wrong with you? And I didn't want to get a big bottle because that would mean I was, like, really an alcoholic. So I would have to do it every day, my bottle and my cigarettes. My friend and I used to call it our medication. And, you know, sad but true, it was a medication in a lot of ways. When I had the neck injury, I had surgery. I was in such bad shape physically, but I didn't even know it. I just knew that I didn't feel good. I knew that my heart was breaking. I knew that I was scared, really scared, and I knew what I was doing. And I knew where I was heading, and I knew I was hurting people. I used to pray, oh, dear God, please don't let me hurt anybody else, and don't let me hurt myself. I couldn't even see how much I was hurting my children who were here in the States, worried sick because they'd call me up, and I'd be all, you know, my feet would be all garbled, and they'd go, Mom, what's wrong? Oh, nothing, you know. But when you take pills and you drink, you know, of course your speech is garbled. I didn't even know what was going on most of the time. I was listening to to Joyce Meyer. I don't know if you guys know who Joyce Meyer is. Some of you probably do. But I was walking into the bathroom to make another drink, because that's where I had my stash hidden in with my winter socks and stuff. God forbid you should leave it out. And I heard her say, there is no pit that you're in that is so deep that God can't pull you out. And I just remember this feeling just washing over me. And I went into the bathroom and I poured that drink out and I poured those bottles out. And by the grace of God in this program, I haven't had to pick up since. You know, and that was great as far as the not drinking part of it. But let me tell you, there's a lot more to it than that. When I went to my first AA meeting, it was in the middle of winter, and I was really frightened that I was going to slip on the ice because I had this neck brace on. And I got out of my car, and I was kind of hanging on to it, and I went down the steps because there they have a lot of meetings and basements and stuff. And I tried to open the door, and I couldn't, and I didn't realize that I didn't have enough strength in my hand to open that door. And I thought, okay, nobody's there. And I walked back up the stairs, and I was heading toward my car, kind of gingerly poking along, trying not to fall. And this man came out of, I don't know where. Well, I actually do know where. I think he was an angel. But he had about three teeth in his head, and his hair was kind of all scrawny. And I think about it, he just had on a flannel shirt. And it was like 30 below zero. You know, and this guy said, lady, are you looking for an AA meeting? And I had my hand on the fender of my car trying to steady myself. And I could hear in my head my higher power tell me, this is it. Don't run. And so I turned to that man. Sorry, I was caught when I did tell this story. And I told him, I'm afraid. I'm afraid. I'm afraid I'm going to fall. I'm afraid. And he walked over and got me. And he took my hand like I was made out of the most precious china or gold. I mean, he just took me down those steps. And I wasn't afraid of falling once he had my hand. And he opened that door and he walked me inside. And somebody came up and said to me, you know, hi, my name is so-and-so. You know, welcome to AA. And they got me a cup of coffee and they sat me down. And, you know, I never laid eyes on that man again. So I really do believe it was an angel. That's my personal belief system. Because I was getting ready to run. I really was. And I feel like my higher power knew. You know, and for those of you that are in here today that feel like running, you know, I hope you let me be your angel and tell you this is it, don't run. Because let me tell you, I have a life now that I never thought I would have. I always talk about, as I said, about women's, not women's issues, but how we feel as women. Because I felt so dirty and so worthless and so cheap. You know, all the people I done things with that I shouldn't have done things with. I mean, half the time I didn't even remember, or somebody you kind of wink, wink. I remember I was working in a bar as a barmaid trying to put myself through school, and there were five guys in there, and they were all smiling and winking at me because I had kids around with all of them. And I remember going in the back room and just springing into a towel and going, my God, what's wrong with you? You know, what are you, a slut? Are you a whore? Why is this happening? I felt so bad about myself. Of course, I went out and had a drink, and that took care of that. But you know what? I still remember how that felt. You know, and I don't mind sharing these kind of things about myself because that's not who I am. That's not who I was. I don't know who that person was. That was somebody that was broken. You know, that was somebody that was sad and in despair all the time. You know, that our paths can take us in a variety of places. You know, I never went to jail. I never lost my job. I never did any of that kind of stuff. And I'm grateful for that, but my despair was just as deep as somebody that had gone to jail or had done some of those things, you know. And I think that all of us, you know, we have to take a look in our hearts to see what is our rock bottom, you know. What is going to make us stop? What is going to make us go, okay, I can't do this anymore. Please, God, help me. You know, for me, I was going through therapy and. The therapist told me, what would you do if your daughter wouldn't let you see your grandchildren? And I had this moment of clarity. It was just like God had just shown a light on me. And I could see exactly what I was. And I knew that if my daughters were any kind of women, that they would not let those kids be around me. And the shame and the revulsion that I felt toward myself, you know, I would go to see that lady. She said, have you quit drinking yet? Pretty soon, I'm thinking about it. You know how we do. Well, as soon as I get over my birthday, after Christmas, after New Year, you know, whatever our excuses are for things. But when I did have my experience, you know, when I felt that lifted from me, it was after that woman had made me realize what I had become, and that's when I really got serious about praying. I wasn't able to stop because of what she said, but I was able to look at myself in the light of clarity, like they say, a moment of clarity. I was able to see myself as being a broken person, and I really needed help, and my higher power gave me that help. When I came back to California, I think I have two daughters, and I think they drew straws to see who was going to get me. You know, it was sad. I was such a mess. I had brought such a disaster to our family with the various marriages and you know, some other things that are just... don't even bear repeating in this particular group, but I created so much havoc that they really didn't want me, but they loved me, but they didn't know what to do with me. You know, they didn't know. I was kind of like an albatross or something around their neck. You know, they had to take care of me because I was their mom, but you. And it took them a really long time, and I was talking with somebody about the meeting about this. It took them a really long time to trust me. And in the beginning, I thought, well, I'm not drinking. You know, I mean, come on, what more do you want? My God, I'm not drinking. I'm not doing all those things. And I wasn't doing all those things, but I didn't love myself. And I didn't have that feeling of acceptance. And that's what I've got in these rooms, is that feeling of acceptance. You know, when they tell you, we'll love you till you can love yourself, they mean it. You know, the reason that we say our names is so that when you come in, somebody goes, hi, John. You know, how are you? Hi, Jean Marie. So that you have that sense of belonging. And I'm so grateful for that because I don't think I could have made it if I didn't have that that sense of acceptance, because I really didn't accept myself. And it took me a long time, and I'm just barely scratching the surface now. To understand that we don't have to be perfect, you know. We're not perfect. We'll never be perfect. And that's okay. You know, we don't have to be something that somebody wants us to be. Maybe our moms want us to be something, or we think we should be, I don't know what, you know, something that we're not. But all we have to be is what we are right in this moment. And when I finally got a hold of that, I mean, it was like such a relief to me, because then I didn't have to be right all the time, you know, and I didn't have to be ashamed. Because I don't know about you guys, but I spent a lot of my time being really ashamed of who I was, what I thought, what my values were, what the things I'd done. I mean, you know, you just kind of hash them and rehash them, and You know, sometimes our families are more than willing to remind us that of the things we've done. You know, and sometimes, you know, we get the nudge from the judge. Sometimes it's people outside of our family that are reminding us. And to be honest with you, I think a lot of times our families are probably the last ones to accept the fact that we've changed or that we're trying to change. They keep waiting for the other shoe to drop. You know, just like we would do if the shoe was on the other foot, we would be waiting for the shoe to drop too, because they'd learn not to trust us. But that feeling of being able not to look for somebody else's trust, but to be able to trust yourself, that's something I got here in the program. I was lucky enough to find a really good sponsor when I got here. She was a real social lady, which I'm a real social person. I like, you know, hi and how are you and all that kind of stuff. And she took me to meetings. I mean, I know people in Fresno. I know people everywhere, you know. And that was real helpful to me because I didn't know a soul when I came here from Alaska. I'm not from this area and, you know, spent most of my time up north. So I didn't know anybody. I didn't know anybody, and I was really scared. I said, oh, my God, I wonder if I can't stay sober here. You know, I remember when I went to my first meeting, it was in Porterville, and I was used to kind of the small meetings. Of course, Alaska, there's hardly any people. And people were jumping up and walking around and laughing and, you know, making a joke out of it. And I remember how terrified I was that I wouldn't be able to stay sober. Because I was so scared. I was so scared. I didn't want to go back to what I was. I certainly didn't want to disappoint my kids again. You know, we shouldn't do it for anybody else but ourselves. But let's face it, you know, our families are pretty important to us. And it was important to me not to let everybody down. I went to another meeting. It took me months to get the nerve up to go to another meeting. And I remember it was in Lindsay. And I remember sitting outside in my car crying. Asking God, please don't let me drink. Please don't let me drink. Please let me find somebody in here. Please let me find someone I can talk to. Please let me find somebody I can connect with, because I was so scared, because I knew where we were headed. We know when we're not going to meetings. We know when we're not working the steps. We're not calling our sponsor. We know, because you have that little feeling inside of yourself, and we can kid ourselves all we want to, but we all know that feeling when you're getting in that thin ice state, and that's where I was that day. And I prayed, and I walked in that meeting, and I told the man in there that I was scared. You know, where I was from, that I was scared I wasn't going to be able to stay sober, and just told him the truth. You know, he was a secretary to me. It was some older gentleman, actually probably my age now, but whatever. And he said, don't worry, honey, you're going to be okay. And the next person that walked in the door was a guy that was from Alaska, lived in the area where I had been. And I had somebody to talk with. I had something to talk to him about. And I remember he took off his old hat that he had, and he gave me his meeting schedule that he had in the hat band of it. And I carried that meeting schedule around with me for a really long time. And I told him several times, you don't know what that meant to me. To have somebody that was welcoming, you know. It's important that we're there for one another. It's important that we welcome one another. That's why the hugs are important up here. You know, it is important. It's very important to be touched. It's very important to be touched in the right way, because I don't know about you guys, but I was touched a lot, but it wasn't in the right way, and it wasn't in a way that was wholesome to me, to my spirit, you know. So anyway, I met this guy, and he told me how to get to these places. I don't know where I was. I was lost most of the time. And he told me how to get to the meetings. And when I showed up at the meeting, it was in Exeter, and he was there. And it was just like, you know, it was just like this, like a lighthouse or something. You know, I was like, oh my God, he's there. I knew I was going to be safe. I knew it was going to be safe, because there was somebody there that said they were going to be there, and they were. And he was gentle, and he was kind, and he introduced me to everybody, and that was kind of the start of my becoming involved in AA in this area. And my sponsor just took me all over the place. As I said, one of the things that was very helpful to me, besides having a good sponsor, somebody you can talk with, is the inner service. You know, I got involved with the inner service pretty early on. You know, I sort of, you know, they call that woo-woo, the AA railroad. You know, when you have a, I don't know, 6 months sobriety in most places, sometimes a year. But then you can be the secretary of a meeting, or you could be the treasurer, or you could be, you know, whatever it was. I mean, I learned that when you put the chairs out or help make the coffee, that's being of service too. Being here tonight is being of service. You know, I don't know if you guys know, but you're being of service to me, because I would have been pretty sad if there wasn't anybody to talk to. You know, I was secretary of several meetings, and there was times when I didn't want to go. I wanted to be kind of willful and go to heck with it. But I had to go because I had to open up the doors, and I had to make the coffee, and I had to set up the chairs. And through those experiences, I learned responsibility. You know, responsibility not only to myself, but responsibility to AA as a whole, responsibility to you guys. That you could depend on me, that I could be there. If I said I was going to do it, I'm going to do it. You know, even if I don't feel like it. You know, I was telling somebody before the meeting, you know, the main premise, as far as I know, of AA is don't drink no matter what, even if your ass falls off. And they told me, if your ass falls off, put it in a paper bag and bring it to a meeting. We'll put it back on for you. And you know, when you're there in a meeting, you may be doing that for somebody and you don't even know it. You don't even know that they're going, oh, thank God, I saw you there before. I recognize your face. You know, I know you. You're still here, and I guess I'm going to be too. There's that sense of hopefulness. The steps of AA are really important. Of course, the first and only one that we have to do 100% is the first one. You know, we have to admit we're powerless over alcohol, that our life has become unmanageable. You know, I have less problem with the unmanageable life than I did with being powerless over alcohol. It took me a while to just go, no, I really am. That stuff is like poison to me. I can't look at it. I don't mess in any way with that kind of stuff. That's the only one we have to do perfect. And the rest of the steps are the ones that help us to see that somebody outside of ourselves can help us. You know, I don't know, I was lucky, I guess, because I had a higher power when I got into the program. But my higher power was pretty mean. I don't know about you guys, but mine was scary. He was going to kick my ass at the drop of a hat. And I always thought I really deserved it, too. If anything happened, anything went wrong, I went, see? What do you expect? I mean, that's honestly the way I felt. I was like, well, you did what you deserve, because that's what I grew up with. That was the message I got from my family of origin. That was the message I got in every step of my life, was you're going to get what you deserve. And it was never like it is for me now. I thought I'm going to get what I deserve now, but it's all good. That's the difference. That's the difference. Once you get a hold of the program, once you get some sobriety under your belt and do the things that you're supposed to do, something happens and your attitude shifts from that attitude of blame and fear to that feeling of expectancy, you know, to the point where you can go, I expect something good to happen. And we're not really surprised when it does. Tell you the truth anymore, I'm surprised when things happen that are negative. You know, but I've learned that you still don't have to drink. And, you know, not drinking is a huge part, of course, of sobriety, but not giving up your emotional or your spiritual sobriety is even more important to me. You know, I don't want anything to rattle my cage. I don't want anything to make me think God doesn't love me. I don't want anything in my life to make me think that you guys don't love me, or that I couldn't walk up to any one of you and say, hey, I'm hurting. Or sometimes my car won't start, or whatever. You know, I didn't have the best example of a dad in my life. My father did things that were very inappropriate to me. And it's just in coming to AA, I mean, I can't stress to all of you how important it is for the women to act like women of honor, like we're worth something, and for the guys to act like that too and to treat us that way, because I don't know about you ladies, but I know for myself, I learned how to value myself from you guys. I mean, I might not know you, you know, I don't want to date you, it's nothing like that, but it's that feeling of being an okay person, of being a person. You're not a set of boobs walking around. You're not any of that stuff. You're a human being. And the same with you guys. You're not just a wallet walking around. You're a person that has value. And we learn that from each other. And I just can't stress how important I think that is, because you get that feeling of being cherished, and then you don't want to not be cherished. When somebody's bad to me now, or they're being disrespectful to me, I know it, and I feel it, and I deal with it right away. You know, it's not me thinking, oh, I probably deserve that, or, well, yeah, what do you expect? I know right away, and I don't have to act like a jerk about it, because that's another thing we learn in this step, is we learn how to behave ourselves. You know, when you do your fourth step inventory, and that was a little rough at first, because you think you have to put down all the rotten things you ever did, and most of us do that real nasty inventory that we think nobody else did any of the kind of stuff we did, and we find out that they did all that and then some. Yeah. But I've learned over the years, there's a lot of times I'll do a four-step inventory on a specific thing. I'll do a four-step inventory on what I'm feeling at work, or a four-step inventory on a marriage that was ending, you know. But I know where to go with that stuff. I know where to go with those feelings. I know who to talk to. I know I need to talk with my sponsor or people that I love and trust. And that is a really beautiful part for us, because I don't know about you guys, but I didn't have a lot of people that I loved and trust. I had a lot of people that I thought I had fooled, or you thought I was funny, or, you know, back in the day when I was a little bit prettier than I am now, I thought, well, maybe my looks, maybe my whatever, I would smell real good, you know, maybe that. But I don't place that kind of value on myself anymore. I place the value on myself as who I am as a child of God. You know, my value is the same to Him as yours is to Him, as all of us are to Him. And that is the most beautiful thing to get a hold of, you know. In the process of doing the fifth step, when you talk it over with another human being, and then you work on giving up your character defects. I mean, a lot of us, I have character defects that I didn't even know I had. And anymore, I'm really okay about trying to give those up. I'm really okay asking to have those removed for me, because I don't feel like once you take all that stuff away, there won't be anything left. You know, a lot of people say it feels like you're going to be the hole in the donut when they pull away all the donuts. There'll be nothing there. And that's not how it is. That's not how it is at all. When you pull away all that stuff, there is a really beautiful person in each and every one of us hiding under there, just waiting to be acknowledged, waiting to reach out, waiting to share, you know, being happy that we're sober and being able to be sober emotionally and spiritually, and be able to give to somebody else, and not giving with any kind of a motive other than to give what you've been given. You know, that's a huge part of the program too, is to give back what you've been so freely given. And what an honor. You know, at first I thought, oh shit, I don't want to do that. You know, I was so selfish. I didn't think I was. I thought it was really nice. I mean, I swear to God, if you had asked me when I got into this program what happened to my life, I would have told you, I don't know, because I'm really a nice person. I didn't think I had any of those defects. I did not think I was selfish. Oh, my God. I mean, I could share. You want a drink? You want a, you know, piece of fried chicken? Here, have it. I didn't have a clue of what it meant to be inside, to not be selfish, to really not be selfish, to even recognize that I was self-centered, selfish and self-centered. And I still am in a lot of ways. But you know what? I'm not as selfish and self-centered as I was when I started. And that is the most beautiful thing when you get to the place where you can look at yourself and go, you know, I'm not where I want to be, but I'm not where I was. And to be okay with that. And to have the people around you say, you're different. You know, I see that smile on your face. I see you nodding your head. You know, I recognize you're nodding your head. And you've been so nice to do that because I'm talking. And I was thinking to myself that that's what we do for one another. When somebody's on the right track and when somebody's saying something that touches you, you know, we're nodding. Come on, come on, come on. You know, I was trying to explain to this lady today what it felt like to reach your bottom. And I said, it's kind of like, you know, I'm sure you guys have all seen movies where, you know, there's this drunk, wimpy guy in the bar and comes up to the big guy, and the big guy punches him out and falls down, and the guy gets up, and the guy punches him again. And finally, the big guy said, for God's sake, stay down. Well, to me, that's kind of how God was. That's how it was for me. You know, it was like, stay down. And then once you're down, then you ask for that help. He'll reach his hand out and pull you up. But you have to be knocked to your knees. And I was. My misery, my pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization knocked me to my knees. And I'm really glad that it did. I'm grateful for every drink that I ever took because it brought me to where I am. I'm grateful that I have a heart for others. You know, it's not about whether you think I'm nice or you think I'm this or you think I'm that. It really doesn't matter. I mean, like you say, I was so selfless that I didn't care, but, you know, that's a damn lie. But for the most part, I'm much kinder than I used to be. I'm much more apt to see you. I mean, really see you with the eyes of my heart. You know, they talk about the language of the heart. And that's what you learn in here. I had no idea what that meant. I had no idea what any of that stuff meant. You know, when you're working the 11th and 12th step, to me, meditating and prayer, I mean, that's a real personal thing. You know, I think we all do it differently. But keeping that conscious contact with God, I've learned to stay in contact with Him. And sometimes even when I think a bad thought, I go, oops, sorry, you know. But I know that didn't break that contact. He didn't break away from me. I broke away from Him. And I can get back just as fast as I want to because He never shuts the door on us. He never slams the door no matter what we've done, no matter who we are, no matter who we've hurt. Your higher power will never shut the door on you. And I'm going to close with that. I'm really grateful that you guys asked me to be of service, and thank you.